The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome back to the live broadcast Tuesday evening Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Glad to be back in town and glad to be back live with you. And we have another excellent show tonight with Dr. Anita Sengupta, who has been with us many times before. More about that in just a minute. As for announcements, tonight is a 60-minute format program. We do have a hard break at 60 minutes. So if you want to talk with our guest, please give us a call on our toll-free number, 866-687-7223, or email us, but make sure you do it before the end of the program, and we would appreciate that. All of the newsletters and our current activity for the coming week are up on the website, and we have a full program going through Sunday. And then one more quick announcement. The last space show that will be done from California is a week from tonight, next Tuesday, and then the program is dismantled to be taken to Nevada for our new home. And right now, due to a bunch of convoluted things requiring for the move, we will resume broadcasting on the 10th, we'll be back on the 11th, so I think the 13th of May is when we resume broadcasting live shows. So more about that on a later program. But Dr. Sengupta is back with us, and she has started a new company that we're going to talk about. And that company is called, she's making a real shot at and a real possibility at having electric airplanes. And we'll let her tell you about it and why she is different from all the other guys I've had on over the last 4 or 5 years claiming that they were trying to do something similar. It's hydroplane.us is the website. She is an aerospace engineer. She's a commercial pilot, a real honest rocket scientist, and a veteran of the space program. Her full bio is up on the website. And you can read it. I want to spend our time talking with her rather than spending time reading her bio. But go to hydroplane.us, and you can follow along with a big part of our discussion tonight. If you are interested in supporting us, I don't want to forget to say that, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation, and listeners just like you support us and keep us on the air. And we deeply appreciate that. And as a nonprofit, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you do get a deduction for your gift. And the same is true for California taxes and possibly other states. Just check with your advisors to be sure about the state deductions, because it varies from state to state. And we have a LogoWare store on our website that you might want to check out. And you get there by going to the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and that will take you to our Space Show store. And if you have ideas or are interested in any of the products there or have suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. In addition to supporting us through PayPal, that is our primary tool, which is up at the top of our homepage, by the way. You can also send a check to 1ONEGiantLeapFoundation.org. And it goes for now to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And in addition, we have sponsors. So our sponsors This is a shorter segment program, so I shout out to Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, National Space Society. And on the longer shows, we read their messages, but we do deeply appreciate these sponsors. And if you're interested in being a sponsor or being part of our billboard advertising program, if you have good ideas and you want to get them out to a larger public, you can use our banner ad program and our message program for that as well. But that does bring me back to our guest, and Dr. Anita Sengupta and her company that she founded, Hydroplane.us. Welcome back to the show, Anita. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, David? Thank you for having me.
I'm doing well. And tell us about Hydroplane, and why is it different from other efforts to make electric airplanes?
Sure. So I am a very avid pilot myself, so I fly pretty much every weekend, and I actually use the pandemic as an opportunity to get a few more ratings, my instrument rating and my commercial rating. I also spent 2 years in the electric vertical takeoff and landing space, which may have been the last time I was on the show, I forget. But whilst I was working on the design of battery-powered electric airplanes, I realized that that was not a good solution for aviation in terms of developing a key technology to decarbonize aviation, and that's because batteries are really heavy, which means that a battery-powered aircraft like the Pipistrel Alpha Electro, I think it's the only one out there that you can get that's truly on the market, it's an ultralight, holds two people, it can only fly for 1 hour at less than 100 miles an hour. So for most aviation use cases, that just isn't much of a solution, because ultimately you want to fly for a couple hours because you want to be able to get from point A to point B, and you probably want to carry more payload, and you probably want to fly at faster speeds. So I found that there was an opportunity, which was to come up with a better way to store electrical energy for an electric aircraft, and that's with hydrogen fuel cell technology.
And where are you at in the development process for this?
So we are in the research and development phase. So the company has existed, you know, in an incorporated sense since July of 2020, and we've been working under contract with the United States Air Force, part of their Agility Prime program. So we completed our first research and development contract in 2021, and we won our second Agility Prime contract just now, and we just started, you know, about a couple of weeks ago. So we are about 8 months away from our first flight demonstration, and about 6 months away from our ground demonstration of the larger system.
So what will your flight demonstration consist of?
So I can't go into too many details just because we are largely in stealth mode, pun intended, but it will demonstrate the end-to-end power plant technology flying in a small aircraft in the Los Angeles County northern desert region, and it will show that we can do the takeoff, the climb out, cruise, and then, of course, you know, a safe landing. And, of course, the goal over time is to be able to carry more hydrogen on board, which will allow us to demonstrate even longer endurances,
so,
up to a goal of basically 1,000 kilometers.
So your fuel is hydrogen, right, instead of the avgas, right?
That's correct. But it's not combusting hydrogen. It is using hydrogen in an electrochemical reaction with a hydrogen fuel cell.
So, okay. And how far away are you, do you think, how far are you from achieving a 1,000-kilometer radius with a flight with a fuel cell?
So the big challenge associated with hydrogen is how you store it on board the aircraft. So if you try and store it as a high-pressure gas, unfortunately the mass fraction of the tanks is too high to be able to give you meaningful range, so you end up just carrying lots of tanks around and not enough actual payload. So the real desire is to be able to go to a liquid hydrogen system. And so we're starting off, obviously, with gaseous hydrogen because that's easier, but the system is configured for liquid hydrogen. So it's hard for me to give you an exact date, but definitely in under 2 years.
Do you think it will ever evolve to where you'd see big super jets being fueled this way rather than on aviation fuel, or is that too much to ask for?
I do, but it requires a evolutionary approach to the technology. So right now, hydrogen fuel cell technology, which is used in automotive, is called a low-temperature PEM, basically a proton exchange membrane. You do need to develop a high-temperature PEM to support aircraft that fly at higher altitudes, such as jets, such as twin turboprops, and that is a goal of our company, is to shift over to that high-temperature PEM technology. But there are a range of aircraft such as general aviation aircraft, such as air taxis, such as helicopters, urban air mobility systems that don't fly at super high altitudes, so the low-temperature PEM technology can work for that.
You already have a quick email from a listener, and this is a listener from San Diego, and he says, what is the market for this type of aircraft? Is there actually a market for it, or are fuel aircraft meeting the market demand right now, and people are satisfied with that?
So it really depends upon what you think the problem is. One person would make the argument that the problem is the cost of fuel is going up. That's true. The argument behind hydrogen actually is it could be a lot cheaper than gasoline and than avgas. And then, of course, the other argument for it is that we want to stop putting out so much CO2. So if we can shift over to carbon emission-free forms of transportation, whether that's on the ground or in the air, that's something that obviously everyone is working towards. So we're trying to solve the problem as a company of both addressing costs by giving people an option as the price of hydrogen is coming down. It's actually now cheaper to fuel my Toyota Mirai. For example, I have a Toyota Mirai. It costs less for me to fuel that car than it does with traditional gasoline. And those same sorts of cost savings can also transfer to the aviation user. So there is an actual economic argument for it.
Are there a lot of air taxis around? I don't know if people see them operating where they live or not, but I'm up in Sonoma County, and maybe I'm just not paying attention, but it doesn't seem like the air taxi is a big part of aviation up in Sonoma County in Northern California. Am I missing something?
So urban air mobility is an area where probably billions of dollars have been invested into it to date. And so urban air mobility requires brand new platforms which have vertical takeoff and landing capability and all the infrastructure assets associated with it. So there is a stepping stone between that urban air mobility sort of, you know, futuristic sci-fi world and what we have today, which is making use of existing general aviation assets, but providing people with a cost-effective alternative. Because right now helicopters are too expensive for regular people to fly, just because helicopters are just inherently expensive in their operational cost per hour, as well as their fuel usage. So if you can shift over to lower cost version of vertical lift applications and or lower cost version of going from point A to point B with existing general aviation assets, that is a possibility for sure. And it is used in other places. So like places where you have, you know, different islands such as New Zealand, having, you know, island hopping services is pretty standard.
Listener Joe in Denver said, is it your aim to not have any battery backup for storage energy at all?
So the way the fuel cell operates, you always require a small amount of battery for ancillary power purposes, but that isn't the primary energy storage mechanism. And basically, you can do a trade taking a look at what if I have some battery, some fuel cell to give me the total power that's required, but it's not the right solution because it's too heavy. So if you're coming back to it from a, well, what do I need from a redundancy perspective, just adding an additional source of electrical power doesn't actually solve your problem, right, if you're trying to address, you know, how do I make my aircraft, you know, be redundant. So you can have redundancy in different ways. You don't necessarily have to have redundancy with a single-engine aircraft, right? A single-engine aircraft has one engine, so it doesn't have redundancy inherent to it. So it really depends upon your design approach and your assessment of the overall system safety.
So your website shows single-engine aircraft. Are you planning, I can understand doing demos and testing with single-engine aircraft, but are you planning to go to multi-engine or even can you do jets with this?
So the desire is obviously to go to larger and larger platforms, and the way to quantify that is in terms of power. So the system is modular, which means it does allow for additional power per propulsion pod. So whether that's a multi-engine platform or whether that's a sort of like a multi-rotor system with urban air mobility, then you can increase the total power, which means you can increase the total payload capability.
Does somebody flying one of these have to do something different to their pilot's license?
Shouldn't need to. So the existing, you know, electric aircraft that do exist, which are pretty much limited to either experimental aircraft or the Pipistrel Alpha Electro, doesn't require anything. So you would still have a single engine land requirement for your license.
Do you have a lot of competition? Can you tell yet? Is it solid competition? I guess there might be a lot of people out there, but they may not be very solid.
So there are many more people entering the hydrogen energy space, whether that's from the infrastructure side, from the ground-based vehicle side, even from the aviation side. But it isn't a flooded market by any stretch of imagination. in comparison, the battery-powered aircraft world, which is the eVTOL world, is very flooded. I think it has over 250 companies in it. So there's probably a handful of companies in this space and, you know, hundreds of companies in the battery-powered space. And that's because, you know, batteries are easier to get. They don't have as many, they're maybe, you could say, better understood. But batteries do have their own challenges with regards to safety, with regards to reliability, with regards to catching fire. And, of course, the biggest challenge for aviation is they're just too heavy.
Well, I was going to say their mass is phenomenal, so you don't have that issue with hydrogen, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, it's a lot better. Yeah, you can get an order of magnitude improvement in endurance.
What about the safety with hydrogen?
So there is a lot of synergies that can be taken with regards to hydrogen storage, hydrogen fueling, and hydrogen use for the automotive use case. You know, there's currently three hydrogen fuel cell cars on the market, one from Toyota, one from Hyundai, one from Honda. And so they have already gone through a lot of the regulatory challenges with regards to ground use and ground safety, which happens to be more difficult than in the air, right? Because you can have, you know, impact collisions in the ground with multiple cars. Whereas with aviation, it's a very different scenario. So it is always going to be a challenge, and safety is always number one. But ironically, if it can be solved for automotive, the aviation problem with regards to safety is a little bit easier.
Everything you're doing is in California, right?
Yeah, I mean, we are a California-based company.
But your R&D is here. You're not overseas or anything else like that, right? Everything is here in the States.
Yeah, everything's in the United States, yeah.
Have you flown a hydrogen plane yet?
Myself? No.
I was going to ask you about the performance, what you thought of it, but...
You're matching the power profile, so that's kind of what you're doing. So you wouldn't really be able to tell a difference between being a pilot flying a piston-driven aircraft versus the hydrogen fuel cell-driven aircraft. The differences would kind of like be perhaps similar to what you experience in a car, but car is also quite different because the power profile for a car has like an impulse versus with an aircraft it's largely steady state. So the real difference, however, it will be a lot quieter. So all of the noise which is generated from the piston engine will be gone. And so for anybody who's driven a gasoline-powered car, an electric car, whether it's a hydrogen or battery-powered one, they know how quiet the car is. So it's actually a tremendous benefit from a noise pollution perspective.
I have another question. Sandra's in Tucson, and she said, if I recall, wasn't hydrogen part of the problem with the Hindenburg? What are you doing differently?
Well, I mean, everybody always likes to comment on the Hindenburg, which is something from, you know, the last century. And so you have to look at how you store it. You have to look at what kind of safety margins you have in the mechanical structures that have to contain it. But in general, hydrogen is a very small molecule, which means it diffuses rapidly. So that as long as you're not in a confined space, it's pretty much gone almost immediately. Whereas gasoline, which is quite dense, actually pools the vapors on the ground, so it can be more flammable. So ironically, gasoline can be more flammable from that perspective than even hydrogen.
You have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program tonight. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Hydrogen. Are you using gaseous hydrogen for this or for liquid?
So the way fuel cells operate is you will always use the hydrogen in a gaseous sense within the fuel cell. How you store it on the vehicle is kind of a engineering trade that you have to do.
Mm-hmm. So how are you planning on storing it? I thought that was really what I was referring to, I guess.
So we are... Well, I don't like to go into too many details of our specific approaches, but our final design is based off of liquid storage.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. And what about range? I mean, obviously that is a lot less dense than say gasoline would be, or aviation gasoline, or whatever. Can you get the same kind of range out of that you could out of a more conventional single engine airplane?
You can get the same range. You will have to have larger tanks, but the tanks actually will weigh less because the hydrogen weighs less.
Yes, it's a volume issue.
So it's a volume issue. Now, if you were going with gaseous hydrogen, then all of a sudden it doesn't work out because then your mass fraction of the tanks is too low, and so then you're just basically flying around a lot of metal or a lot of composite to store that. But when you go with the liquid system, you can get a lot more efficient. But at the end of the day, our wing loading for the same endurance is half. The total weight of the fuel. So you can get to the endurance that you want, which is ultimately what you want as an aircraft owner operator.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, I know there's an article in the latest the aerospace AIAA magazine, you know, that about the whole issue of hydrogen aircraft. I think more in terms of commercial, you know, bigger things. But I was kind of a little bit surprised that I would have thought that hydrogen would have a real deficit because of the density issue, but you're saying really not, huh?
It depends on how you store it. And it's not to say that it isn't a challenge to develop the system to do it that way. And ironically, the hardest place to try and configure it is in a small aircraft, right, because you've got less volume to play with and less mass to play with. But it can be done. And, you know, so basically as you go up in size, it becomes a little bit of a simpler problem, depending upon what your service ceiling is. If you're going to fly it too high of an altitude, then all of a sudden you don't have enough oxygen in the air. Then you have to run your air compressor, which sucks away some of the electricity and generates more heat. So it becomes more of a challenge as you go up in altitude, which is why for, you know, jet applications or for even, you know, twin turboprop applications, you really want to go with a higher temperature temp so that you don't have as many thermal challenges.
Very interesting. Well, I just since this is a short show, I'll leave the line for somebody else. But this is fascinating, the development.
Thank you, John.
Well, thank you for your question.
Thank
okay,
you. Listener, John is off the phone. You can certainly give us a call, 866-687-7223, and email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. Given the status of the industry today, where would you be able to lay over to refuel, or how would you refuel since you're working with some kind of fuel cells and things? So how does the refueling take place?
So hydrogen infrastructure is probably the biggest challenge to enabling a hydrogen economy in all sectors of transportation and in all sectors of energy use, because hydrogen infrastructure doesn't exist outside of California right now in the United States. So the Toyota Mirai and all of the, you know, car vehicles that are powered off fuel cells can only be sold in California. So that infrastructure challenge obviously would spill over to aviation. It's less of a challenge in the sense that you don't have to have a gas station, you know, every few miles. You only have to have a few gas stations at the airports that you're planning to service. So it becomes less of a challenge from an infrastructure perspective, but it does require governmental support, public-private partnership to make that happen. You can, of course, get access to hydrogen by calling up, you know, companies like Air Products, Air Liquide, as a means of getting a delivery directly to your hangar or to your airport facility. And you also have the ability to make your own hydrogen. So the real holy grail scenario for hydrogen is that you can make your own airplane fuel by having access to electricity and an electrolyzer. So it changes everything in that sense. And one of the reasons why I think people are so interested in it, even on the governmental side, is it allows us to take away our dependence on foreign oil as our energy source.
You have another caller on hold. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
And my question is, many aircraft have wet wings, but a wing full of hydrogen would be called what?
Well, I suppose it would still be called a wet wing, because if we're stirring it as a liquid, it's still going to be in liquid form. But I would say it would still be called that.
So literally re-engineering the wing to be your hydrogen storage tank, is that really feasible?
Well, you don't have to re-engineer the wing, and basically, if you already have an aircraft, you know what the attachment points are and what the load is to be that. If you're hanging a wing, basically like a tank pod off of that, which many aircraft already have, you're not even changing the design of the structure of the wing. So then you're just looking to see what the aerodynamic effects are of having a, you know, a nice-looking, you know, aerodynamically shaped tank pod descending beneath it.
Yeah, well, my airplane, there's a few guys that put 5-gallon tanks out on the middle of the wings, so I'd have to think about the equivalent hydrogen size tank. Very interesting. Thank you.
Sure. And that is part of our design process, is to design the tanks and to ensure that they are aerodynamically shaped to minimize, you know, additional drag that you might get from it.
Mm-hmm. Until next time, then.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Marshall's one of these guys who's building his own airplane.
And, oh, excellent.
But obviously it's aviation gas fueled. It's not hydrogen fueled. But he's been working on it for quite a while and is building it out on his farm in Oklahoma. He wants to fly it to the West Coast, I think, later this summer. Hopefully he has good life insurance. So.
Well, maybe we can give him one of our power plants.
Well, and he needs to name the space show as a beneficiary. So we'll sponsor you, Michael Marshall, but you got to name us as a beneficiary. So, do you can you take a normal? Well, I don't know what normal would be. What would to fly passengers? I mean, are you going to be limited to how many passengers you can take, and how long do you think that kind of size limitation will last before you can sort of ramp up to a much bigger, a more efficient thing, maybe like a commuter-sized flight?
So I think, you know, we're focused on the technology development of an aviation-specific fuel cell to reduce its volume, to reduce its weight, give you better specific power. That always translates into the ability to carry more cargo and or fuel to go longer distances. You know, from a cost efficiency perspective and even from an engineering development perspective, it makes sense to start small because you can get through all of your challenges in that smaller platform and then work your way up in power. So there's nothing inherent in what we're doing which can't support, you know, a larger type of aircraft like, you know, a Pilatus or something like that. So that obviously would be our goal, but it's more cost efficient for us to operate with an even smaller platform. And if we can solve that problem, we literally could solve the larger platform more easily because there's more volume available to us to, you know, reconfigure the power plant. There are, of course, lots of regulatory steps that you have to go through anytime you're developing any new technology for an aircraft, whether that's brand new avionics, whether that's a brand new engine, or in this case, a brand new power plant, right, an electric propulsion power plant to replace an internal combustion system. And so those are, you know, the engineering challenges that we as a company have to go through, but it's a process. A lot of the companies in the electric vertical takeoff and landing space have been going through it, which is a completely new aircraft in addition to a new power plant. And so for us, it's actually a lot easier because pre-existing aircraft, if you stay within their structural limitations, then you just have to make sure that everything's safe and compatible, and then you can get the endurance and the reliability that you need off the power plant itself. But it's like, you know, some Lycoming or Continental coming up with a brand new engine, they have to go through an STC process for each airframe. We would have to do the same thing for ours.
Is the FAA, working with developers such as yourself, or are they hard to work with on something really new and different like this?
Well, I would never say anything negative, but actually, no, they're not at all hard to work with. FAA actually has been pretty amazing, I would say, over the past 5 years in working really closely with electric vertical takeoff and landing developers, and they also have people, you know, in different divisions across the country who have expertise in electric propulsion. And so we are working within those constraints. There's also FAA-designated I forgot what they're called. They're called DERs and DARs you can work with as an alternative if you're working on, like, experimental initial flights, which is what we're doing. But that process, I personally do not think holds up anybody's development. And I think it's really important that people do things safely because it's good for the whole industry, right? When somebody makes a mistake, when someone gets hurt, that is bad for, obviously, all the people in the air, all the people on the ground, but it's also bad for the industry.
Jack is in Boston. And he says, are you considering some kind of public company status, maybe a SPAC or something else, where other people can get in on it rather than just through private investment?
Oh, well, so, I mean, we are a, you know, a Delaware C Corp in terms of our company model. And every time we do a fundraising round, you know, the investment opportunity is open to, I believe, accredited investors,
right,
the definition of that. I'm not an expert in any of these terms, so please don't quote me on any of these things. But I am considering for the next round that we do, we already closed our seed round, but when we do our Series A round, I would consider opening up a, I think it's called a Reg D, which means that anybody could invest. there you could only there's only a certain amount of money you could raise. I forget what it is. I think back in like 2019 it was like a $1.05 million limit for a Reg D round. But I have considered doing that just so that, you know, everybody can invest and that they can be kind of more part of the process of decarbonizing aviation. But it is something that we're looking into. But obviously it doesn't raise a lot of capital for the company, because when you're in aviation you have to raise a lot of money, right, because you're doing a lot of hardware development. But it is a way for everybody to get involved. So I think that's something that I would like to do as the, you know, CEO founder.
Have you thought of one of the Kickstarter equity programs?
Well, we don't need that. So we were able to raise funding directly with investors, because I know, you know, I've been working in the field for quite some time. So those types of platforms, they usually take, I would argue, too much, like percentage-wise as a fee.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's better just to be able to directly raise the money, you know, through directly accepting funds. But I haven't decided. You know, I'm open to all the different things. And I think if we did it, we would go through a climate tech sort of like entity, just because we'd like to engage with that community, because we're really focused on decarbonization. That's the ethos of the company.
What are these? What's the climate tech company? I mean, they would do the fundraising for you, and
I think Impactor, which is a kind of a green sort of what do you call it, like technology media house. I think they have an arm that would do something like that. All I'm trying to say is that I would want to go through something which has kind of like, you know, wanting to support climate technology as its focus, as an entity that we would go with. We wouldn't just go with any entity.
Sherry is in Seattle, and she says, what is the progress on what you're trying to do by others outside of the United States? Are there people in Europe and other countries trying to do the same thing?
There are, for sure. And even Airbus came out with some news recently in the past probably 6 weeks about how they did a hydrogen flight demonstration. But I think the way I always like to comment on that is that, you know, companies like Airbus and Boeing are, you know, multi-billion dollar international corporations. So if they were truly serious about making rapid progress, they probably already would have products on the market. So it really does come down to startups, I think, that are really innovative to make rapid progress. And it's great that if there are companies around the world working on this, because there's more than one solution. There's also many challenges associated with getting a hydrogen fuel cell power plant operational in an aircraft. So at the end of the day, if different people are solving different parts of the problem, we might be able to work together, and it will just push forward the hydrogen economy. But as with the auto industry, as well as with the airplane industry, there's never only going to just be one company. There's always going to be many companies, and that competition is healthy because it forces further innovation.
Your website says it can be certified under FAA Part 23. Tell us what specifically Part 23 is about.
Because it's a small aircraft, so that's possible. So if it was a much larger aircraft, that wouldn't be possible. So that's one of the reasons why starting small makes a lot of sense, because
uh-huh.
you get a lot of engineering understanding and even the certification aspects done on that smaller platform. And it allows the company to be to show how they are compliant within the operating limitations that they have selected for themselves in terms of a service ceiling, in terms of like maximum crosswind, in terms of gross takeoff weight, in terms of off-nominal conditions. So it allows you to have more control of the design process and show how you're compliant within those operating limitations. But ultimately, it's a way to get something to market faster, and it gives the company more flexibility. And that's a recent change, I'd say, from the FAA within the past, you know, less than 10 years.
Carl is also in Denver, and he says, are you big enough? Do you have interns? Do you hire people out of school? What's the status on entry-level people maybe getting a job with your company that share your ideals and goals?
Oh, so we're very much in a scale-up phase right now. We just hired 2 additional full-time people over the course of the past last month, and then we're probably bringing on a total of 4 to 6 interns. So we very much do have intern opportunities, and those can be remote, and they could also be in person. And obviously, you know, we were formed during the pandemic, so everybody was working remotely on that perspective. But yeah, we are growing, and we kind of grow in spurts. Right, so we grow to a certain size to support a certain type of demonstration, then we grow again to support another demonstration. But, yeah, we will always have more and more opportunities as we grow as a company.
How does someone find out about your intern opportunities?
So we've been lucky enough to have had relationships directly with certain universities and gotten interns directly from them. And so for this summer, I think we're part of the Citrus program. We're also getting USC interns. We already have UCI interns. We're getting Antelope Valley College interns. We have these direct relationships with all these wonderful institutions, you know, in the vicinity of where we're based. But I think so for this summer, we probably don't have like a blanket open internship because we've already filled them. But for next summer, we could probably, we'll post it on our website.
So look for the website down the road.
Yeah, it's just because we're still relatively small, it makes sense to utilize, you know, connections that you may already have, just because I have lots of connections with different professors at different universities. But as we get bigger and bigger, then that will open up even more opportunities. So then obviously a more general search would be appropriate.
As you start out, and obviously you start small and scale up, what is an expected service ceiling for a hydrogen fuel cell powered airplane?
So we are looking at 10,000 feet MSL as a reasonable service ceiling. And ultimately, because these are unpressurized aircraft, we really wouldn't go above 12,500 anyway, because then you have to carry supplemental oxygen. So we're kind of staying within the range of what these existing platforms already can do. The challenge, of course, when you go up in altitude is that you have less oxygen present, which means that you have to have more electrical power being diverted from primary power to power a compressor. And so you start to have diminishing returns, and then more electrical heat, it means more heat, which means more thermal management challenges. So that's the reason why we don't think that the low temperature PEM technology is the right solution for like a 25,000 foot plus application. We think that's a Gen 2 system, which we are working on eventually, which would support those higher altitude environments.
So if you're the pilot and you need power quickly, if you push on the throttle to get power quickly, does it respond as quickly as a gas-powered Cessna or Piper or small aircraft, or is there a lag?
It responds as quickly, if not quicker. And I can give you that demonstration, you know, personally, operationally, with my hydrogen fuel cell power car.
And another question I had, are you making the body and the fuselage of the plane, or is that from another aircraft manufacturer and you're amending it to work with your systems?
So for our initial product that we're developing both for Agility Prime as well as for our commercial customers, we're developing the power plant. We're not developing a new aircraft. So we're designing the systems to be compatible with a range of different aircraft. And so that makes a lot more sense, in my opinion, because why reinvent the wheel if there's an airplane that also already works perfectly well? There's no sense in coming up with a new aircraft that would give you the exact same aerodynamic performance. You could make the argument that, well, then you can configure it to best support, like, your tanks, but that's also a very costly thing to do. It's a much longer-term proposition to get a new aircraft, you know, basically certified. So this is a solution where we are a power plant developer, not an aircraft developer.
Can you put your power plant in a high-wing aircraft? I was looking for high-wing aircraft pictures, but I didn't see any on your site.
So we did a trade of which platform we wanted to use first, but yes, there's nothing about the system that is not compatible between a high-wing or a low-wing, because it's not a gravity-fed system either way.
So you just went with the low-wing for whatever reason?
Yeah, I mean, I personally like the way the low-wing aircraft look better. and I think they actually perform a little bit nicer from a pilot's perspective, but both are compatible.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Cessnas with the high-wing were sometimes, on windy days, a lot more difficult and challenging to deal with.
And I mean, I fly Cessnas all the time, so it's not that I like them both. Like, I fly Cessnas probably more than I do Pipers, just because I've got access to more Cessnas. But I think they're both. I think the low wings are just more beautiful.
Are there any performance contest races that hydrogen aircraft could enter into? Is there enough interest to do anything like that, or are there even, you know, races with high-performance hydrogen cars? I'm just wondering if the hydrogen propulsion is getting into the racing side of things.
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, I know there's always electric vehicle, and those have traditionally been battery-powered, at least for ground-based systems. But I'm pretty sure that when you have an entrant that, you know, could participate, that it would most likely be allowed, as long as everyone deemed that it was, you know, appropriate for whatever the specifics are. But I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure if I Googled it, I would find out. But certainly, for air races, there's no reason why you couldn't either. You'd have to coordinate ahead of time with the logistics to ensure that you have, you know, access to your hydrogen supply, but one would imagine that could also be done.
That's right. We'll see you flying in the Reno air races someday, so.
Yeah, I hope to be the first hydrogen commercial pilot.
Now, well, so then is, what would you have to do to get a commercial pilot's rating for a hydrogen craft? Would you, anything?
Oh, nothing.
Different?
I already am a commercial pilot, so I would be by default.
So
flying in it.
So there's no special requirement for that then?
No, the ratings are rated off of single engine land, single engine sea, multi engine land, multi engine sea, and you have to get a type rating for, you know, jet aircraft, and then I think aircraft over, I forget what it is, 12,500 pounds or something like that. So no, nothing unusual would be required, which is what's so great, right? Because when you look at a really complicated platform like those, you know, the eVTOL things, you know, those are maybe too difficult for people to fly, period, and requires, like, levels of autonomy, which then makes it even more difficult to certify. So this is super simple. Anybody with a pilot's license could fly their aircraft reconfigured with our power plant.
Tim is in Miami, and he says, I'm curious if atmospheric conditions, specifically temperature, like a hot day or a cold day, how they affect the hydrogen propulsion plant.
So it very much is an air-breathing propulsion system, just like a, you know, piston-driven engine is, right? Because you are still using oxygen to complete the chemical reaction, which ends up generating water as the exhaust product. So you are very much sensitive to high temperatures, you know, high-density altitude conditions. But you would couple that to whatever your service ceiling is. So is your service ceiling, if you were 10,000 feet, it would be 10,000 feet, you know, pressure altitude or 10,000 feet density altitude. You would still have those limitations. So you do require the oxygen to be able to complete the electrochemical reaction.
Interesting. I'd love to fly in one of these things. So
I will definitely take you up, David, when we're ready for it.
Well, you're not ready for it yet, right?
Not tomorrow.
it sounds like it would it would be really, really interesting. So is it 100% clean burning in terms of emission, or I guess water vapor is what comes out of it, right?
Yeah, so water comes out of it. I mean, it's really funny because I have my hydrogen power car, and there's a button on the dash which says H2O. You push that button, and it just releases the water that it has cached. So the plane would be the same. It would just be pushing out water as the exhaust product. Now, there is an argument to be made about where does your hydrogen come from, because right now you have gray hydrogen, blue hydrogen, and green hydrogen. Gray hydrogen is hydrogen which is produced by a hydrocarbon reforming process, which means obviously there's a CO2 output for that. Blue hydrogen is gray hydrogen, but you have carbon capture to reduce the total CO2 output. And green hydrogen is, of course, the ultimate solution, which is where you have electricity, which is generated by renewables such as solar or wind, which is run through an electrolyzer to produce green hydrogen. And that truly does have no carbon output from the source.
What kind of range do you get in your hydrogen car?
So it really depends on how you drive it, but anywhere from 300 to 350 miles. So it's pretty much like any other sedan. But from a fuel economy perspective, and this is a confusing one because they like to do miles per gallon equivalent and they associate it with 1 kilogram, you get at least twice the fuel economy because of the efficiency and the electrochemical reaction and because of the energy density in hydrogen.
When you drive your car, do you take it on trips? Do you know where you can get refueled?
Yeah, so there's a website. So, unfortunately, you can't go outside of California, so that's a big drawback,
right.
Obviously.
Uh-huh.
And there's tons of stations in Southern California. There's tons of stations in Northern California. There's not so many in between, so there's one in Santa Barbara and one in Coalinga. So you do have to do some planning to make sure that you'd be able to get there. But there is a website which shows you the status of each station. It even tells you how much of the hydrogen is green hydrogen for that given station. And there's also an app on the car that you just go to, and it shows you where your nearest station is relative to you. And it also tells you the status of it.
Is it anytime soon going to go outside of California, or is that set for a long time to come, probably?
You know, I don't know enough about, you know, the plans at the federal level, but I know that it does require state-specific initiatives to make this happen. I believe there was some interest maybe in, like, Oregon. One would think, people in Michigan would be working on it, given the car industry there, but I don't know that GM has a car offering on that front. But there are initiatives coming from the federal level for tax credits, you know, for people who are producing energy, which would then go into green hydrogen production. But there's got to be more sort of grassroots support from it within certain states. So one would think it could be the Sun Belt, right, going from California to Nevada to Arizona, because there's just lots of excess electricity. And one of the arguments for hydrogen as an energy carrier is that there is excess capacity in renewable energy plants, whether that's solar or wind, and that excess capacity can go directly into an electrolyzer, which then produces hydrogen, which then can be used in a fuel cell to provide power, you know, when the sun is gone or when it's not windy out. So people need to think about kind of the end-to-end energy solution. There was actually a hydrogen village up in Sacramento at the Capitol that we were showcased at a few weeks ago. So there's so many people working in the space right now, but we obviously need to go beyond California, right? So hopefully Nevada will be next.
You have a David in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he says, is there a hybrid possibility between what you're doing and maybe a conventional fuel backup?
I would say that you could configure, for example, like a multi-engine aircraft to do that. But at that point, you're adding so much complexity and you're adding a lot of like unneeded weight because you've got these two systems that it's probably not the right mass solution. There could be an argument to do that from like a safety perspective. Well, I've got one engine and it fails, but we're going with a single engine aircraft system. And by definition, the single engine aircraft system doesn't have redundancy. So you would never have a reason to have like a redundant fuel mechanism because you've only got one engine. And for smaller aircraft, right, your requirement is that you have sufficient altitude margin so that if you did lose engine power, then you could make an emergency landing. You know, there's also, you know, some aircraft such as Cirrus have a ballistic recovery system. Once again, some single engine that's a backup mechanism to help in the event of an engine failure. But I don't think that would be a very NAS efficient solution, and it doesn't really get to the core of the problem, which is trying to decarbonize. So it just makes sense to show that the system has the reliability that you need in ground-based demonstration and then show that it can operate throughout the, you know, the full operational envelope, which takes into account temperature and altitude, and then get your comfort level from a reliability perspective that way. But to be honest with you, internal combustion engines are far more not as reliable, right, because they're experiencing high temperatures, extreme wears, whereas an electric motor and a fuel cell basically has no moving parts. So it's actually a much more reliable system inherently.
I would imagine imagine that would be so. Do you have a timeline? Well, let me say this. Randy is over there in Flagstaff, Arizona, and there may be some confusion on this. He says, since I understand you're really interested in doing the propulsion more than the aircraft, is there a timeline for you to an operating aircraft on a commercial basis, or do you want to perfect the propulsion system and sell it to other users?
So I would say a little bit of both. And so we do have a government customer, so we would also obviously like to sell it to our government customer, and then that covers through, you know, the Air Force has their own certification process, which is independent of the FAA. Our system can also be used on the ground. It can also be used in boats. It can be used in people who own existing aircraft who simply want to overhaul the engine. Instead of going with a piston-driven engine, you would go with our power plant. If you're an experimental aircraft, you could take it tomorrow if you wanted to. If you are already an existing airworthiness certificate on your aircraft, you would have to wait until we complete our STC process. But our goal is to be able to make this system commercially available so that everybody who currently owns their aircraft can shift over to this power plant instead of a piston-driven power plant, and for it to be completely certified for your airframe so that it is a swap and replacement for you, and your airworthiness certificate continues unimpeded.
Could you take like a Piper Cherokee and take out the gasoline engine and put yours in it?
Yes.
Without very much modification?
Well, you'd have to make some modifications, obviously, but the goal is that we would get it to a bare minimum. It's something which is a turnkey system. It's something which is already certified. You know, some mechanic would obviously do it for you. You're not allowed to do that kind of replacement yourself anyway. And so for you, it would be invisible to you, right, because you're just paying a fee to get this thing replaced, whether it is with a brand-new Lycoming engine, a overhauled Lycoming engine, or a hydroplane power plant.
fascinating. But then you'd probably need a lot of other things if you went to the hydrogen power plant. You'd probably have different instruments and things, I would imagine, right?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, a lot of it could be done with a JPI interface. But nevertheless, I don't want to say what it is today because our focus is on the research and development to get to a high-efficiency system. So if there was a modification where you had to add an additional instrument, we would do that within the constraints of something that you could take out and put in instead. But a JPI, for example, right, you could it has a lot of additional ports that you can read it information.
So are we looking at 5 years before this is on the market, or shorter or longer? What's your best guess?
Less than 5 years.
Less than 5 years.
Yes. That's our goal, obviously. Now, with any engineering development, you have to, get through all of your development phases. You have to go through the regulatory process. You have to go through the certification process. But the goal is to have this available, certainly for experimental aircraft community, much sooner than that. But the goal would be to go through an SBC process in less than 5 years. And that's certainly our goal, and we'll do, everything we can to make that happen. But we also have government customers. We think there's other ways that we can get the product into use for those use cases. And there's also mobile energy storage use cases for it as well.
So are you are customers already showing up saying they want this, or is it all sort of ramping up simultaneously? I mean, I guess is there already a market and it's starting to develop, even though the market is ahead of the technology?
Well, I would say, we've largely been in stealth mode, so we're literally only coming out of stealth mode this month, so that was why I pushed off our call until April. So by definition, no, we haven't had the phone lines open, but we are going to be at Oshkosh this summer, so I think that'll be our first, sort of like foray into the experimental aircraft community to let them know that this is going to be available to them in the near future.
So can you fly it at Oshkosh, or is it just on the ground as an exhibit to come see?
Oh, yeah, we'll have a booth at Oshkosh.
Okay, so you can't fly it at Oshkosh yet.
That's not our plan, no.
Well, this is it's going to be interesting to watch it evolve, and especially if you come out of stealth mode and you start sending out press notices and things. And are you planning?
and I think, something else that is important is that, there is a race going on right now in automotive, which is fuel cell versus batteries. And so, technically the race has already been won for aircraft because we know that batteries can't solve the problem. But shifting over to hydrogen as an energy carrier has a lot of benefits for society. It affects the marine sector. It affects trucking. It affects trains, buses. So there's a lot of synergy in all of the people working in the space, and not to mention space. So when we put together our Agility Prime proposal, we actually had a letter of support from NASA Johnson Space Center, because the durability argument, which is required for any, form of propulsion for aircraft, actually benefits space applications. Because if you're going to have a fuel cell as your energy storage source on a human mission to Mars, for example, it has to have much better durability than what's currently available on the market. So there are many. And that's kind of another business unit I would like to have us have in a few years as a space unit.
So one of the things I've noticed and have said to a few listeners that are closer to me than maybe others is the abundance of public relation firms promoting every little thing possible for this or that company in space. And this industry has grown, 1,000 times over in the past 2 or 3 years. I mean, you would not believe the amount of trivia that is being promoted, and they want to come on the show, or they want to do this or that. And it's maybe 20 or 25 of these notices a week from companies you've never heard of that are out there. I'm assuming you're a long way from that kind of saturation, but is that sort of a direction that you would like to see the industry go, or do you think it can be more constructive without that kind of, I don't know how to describe it, but to me it's not great saturation, even though it is saturation.
Well, I mean, I am doing this to solve a challenge, an environmental challenge. So everything that I'm doing is with that in mind. I'm not the expert on the PR front. I'm not the expert on the, total addressable market front for all technologies in hydrogen. But I would say it's very much an up-and-coming sector. And unlike new space, which is really cool and has great business potential, the hydrogen sector is really cool, has great business potential, and it solves whole bunch of challenges here at home. So I can see it taking off in the same way, but I can actually have it see it having far more of a really important impact on society.
Well, I would love to get notices and follow what you're doing, and I think it's really interesting, and I hope you make really, really fast progress, because I'm getting older. Not only would I like to ride in such a plane, I would like to see it enter the marketplace. Not just, you know, as an experimental, but as a real commercial option for the market and for users and end users. And I'd like to see this innovation take place.
Absolutely, and that's what I want too, because my primary hobby is flying small airplanes, and so this is for my community as much as it is for all the larger airplane communities out there. And you will be one of the first VIPs, David.
Well, I would appreciate that. You could just hurry it up. Is hydrogen, if you're going to buy it and not make it, is it going up in price like gasoline, or is it more of a constrained market for it?
Well, so the interesting thing is it keeps on getting cheaper for me to fuel my Mirai, relatively speaking, to the gas prices. So it's not going up in price the same way that that gasoline is, just because it comes from a different source, right? And if it is produced locally with green hydrogen, with electricity, then that market actually, it benefits from it, right, to actually reduce the price. And so the projected cost, I think, for hydrogen is going from what it currently is at like $13 a kilogram, going all the way down to $4 a kilogram. It will be significantly cheaper to fuel your car with hydrogen and significantly cheaper to fuel your airplane with hydrogen. So the economic case is already there, and it just gets better.
And yet we don't hear it talked about when they push for alternatives to the gasoline engine. They just talk about regular electric, which comes.
I think it's because Elon Musk is not a supporter of hydrogen fuel cell technologies, and everybody jumped on the Elon bandwagon, unfortunately. And they're not thinking of the bigger picture, which is there should be a range of solutions. Batteries are great for small cars. They're not the right solution for large trucks, buses, and even large SUVs.
So I guess Musk does influence that market that much. So have you ever talked to him about hydrogen?
I have not, I just think that, you know, his car has a sweet spot. It's an amazing car, and battery is perfect for his product offering. But as you go larger and as you address these other markets, it's not the right solution.
It's an interesting world. That's all I can say.
But it's much better now than it ever was in terms of innovation in this area, and so he does need to be given a lot of credit for that, obviously, right, since he pushed electric cars into the forefront.
Right, and the innovation is amazing, and I guess we need to stay open to all sorts of new products and new technologies that are going to come our way that maybe we didn't think about yesterday. So
Absolutely. To diversify our energy portfolio.
When I took flying lessons when I was a senior at the University of Arizona, so this is many, many, many decades ago, there wasn't ever any concept of anything other than a gasoline-powered engine for the plane. I mean, that's just a given. There were no options. There was nothing other than if you wanted to fly a glider. But that has really changed, and so it would be fun to learn to fly in a hydrogen plane.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I think it really changes everything. So it really changes everything, and just removing our dependence on oil, and specifically foreign oil, if we learned anything from the past couple of months, so important.
Absolutely. Have we forgotten or omitted anything in tonight's discussion? Is there anything we should have asked you or that you wanted to say that we haven't said yet?
No, I mean, we will be at Oshkosh. We will be at eBase, and we're definitely coming out now. And so if people want to follow us on Twitter, we're at Hydroplane Aero, on Facebook, Hydroplane Aero, LinkedIn, Hydroplane Aero, and then we also have our website. But, yeah, we'd love to have more of a social media following, and we believe that this is a movement, and that's why we want everyone to be on board with it.
Okay. Well, keep us posted, and we'll keep our audience updated as well. And best of luck with it, and I look forward to seeing it develop sooner than 5 years, hopefully. So we'll look forward to that from you, and welcome you back anytime you want to update us.
Thank you so much, David. Have a wonderful evening.
You too. Thank you. And listeners, thank you very much for your your emails and your calls. It's good to be back after having been gone for a week. And it's good to be back and talk about innovation and new technologies and new solutions to things rather than some of the same old, same old. So everybody have a great week. It's still young. And as we like to say, always keep looking up. Thank you for your calls and your emails. And we thank Anita for sharing the information about her company and about hydrogen in airplanes and other uses. And again, we'll look forward to following you on that. And come back again for Friday and Sunday on the Space Show. Hotel Mars for Tomorrow with John Batchelor is still unknown, unidentified, but we are working on that. So everybody have a great week. Stay healthy and safe. Goodbye from Anita, David, and the Space Show.